Unions call for better wages for NDIS workers, and fishing equipment is hurting animals on Gari. Hello, I'm Harrison Peterson with the latest from NIRS News. A group of Australian unions have launched a fight to secure minimum payment rates at the Fair Work Commission. The action follows claims some NDIS workers are being underpaid by as much as $9 an hour. The unions want providers to stop classifying staff as home care workers instead of social and community service employees. Angus McFarlane from the Australian Services Union says the action will set a precedent for the National Disability Insurance Scheme.
So this is a landmark case in the sense that it is basically trying to end once and for all this really dodgy practice of wage theft, and I would call it fraud, within the NDIS.
Animals on Queensland's Gari are sustaining life-threatening injuries from discarded fishing equipment.
For instance, you know, you have your wongaree, like we've had ones where, you know, it's stuck in the mouth of the wongaree, a hook, and that could be there for some time, obviously causing, you know, discomfort to them, you know, to eat, then can get infected. If it's, you know, gets too infected and they become ill, that could lead to euthanasia.
That's Tessa Wire, the Ranger and Community Engagement Officer at the Butchala Aboriginal Corporation, speaking to NIRS News. Rangers say at least 7 dingoes, also known as wongaree, have had to be treated for serious injuries after getting snagged on fishing lines, hooks and lures. Rangers are calling for tourists to clean up after themselves when they visit the national park. There'll be more after this.
Have you heard about the Territory Stolen Generations Redress Scheme?
It's for Stolen Generations survivors who were removed from their families or communities in the Northern Territory, ACT or Jervis Bay.
It's a financial and wellbeing package for acknowledgement and to help with healing.
The scheme's open for applications now.
To find out more about the Territory's Redress Scheme, call 1800 566 111.
Or visit territoriesredress.gov.au.
Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra.
Program sponsor.
Experts say more data is needed to understand why more people are dying on Australian roads. New statistics have revealed the last 12 months were the deadliest on the nation's roads in more than a decade. The latest data shows 1,310 people have died on the nation's road in the past year, an increase of more than 10% on the previous figure. The RACQ's head of public policy, Dr. Michael Caine, has told the ABC it's a national tragedy.
There's something changed, something is different with the road toll, and this is why it's so important that we get data, consistent data on a national basis from all the states so that we can understand what is happening, because this is a national tragedy.
6 new bulk billing urgent care clinics have been announced for regional and remote parts of the Northern Territory. The services will provide free and culturally appropriate urgent care to local communities. The Commonwealth has pledged almost $24 million in funding, which will be used to transform existing medical centres into the new urgent care clinics. CEO of Aboriginal Medical Service Alliance of the Northern Territory, John Patterson, says the funding will add value to the already overstretched clinics.
Particularly in the remote locations that the Minister's alluded to, this will allow after-hour care in those remote clinics that have been successful in becoming the urgent care clinics. It'll also provide and hopefully reduce the medevac arrangements that may require, you know, patients to be treated locally with the specialist care that these clinics will provide.
Some early polling is suggesting that Kamala Harris has a small lead over Donald Trump in the race to become the US president. A Reuters Ipsos poll says that she has a 2% lead over the former president after gaining the support of top Democrats.
Well, there have been a bunch of polls that came out. This one, the latest, shows her ahead. Others show her a little behind. But what they all show, as far as I can tell, looking at them today, is that she has gained significant ground on where President Biden was.
That was Washington Post national politics columnist E.J. Dionne speaking to the ABC. Donald Trump says he would be willing to have multiple debates with Vice President Harris before the election. And that is the latest from NIRS News.
What is greatness?
It's doing what makes you feel proud. What feels right for right now.
when you can study hands-on, all in, practical, professional,
personal. When you can learn local and give back to your community, you define your greatness. Find support of teachers who are there for you at TAFE Queensland. Make great happen. RTO 0275.
Tax cuts are here, and people will now start to see them in their take-home pay. The Australian Government's tax cuts are for every taxpayer, helping Australians keep more of what they earn. Visit taxcuts.gov.au. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra.
Station sponsor.
Hey, Bill and Gunner, welcome to Black Law Tribal Edition. Murumu here with you today as we project the audio recording all across this continent that many call Australia on the spectrum that belongs to the tribal nations. And we thank you for that. May God's peace be upon you wherever you are listening to this show. And joining me today is the Attorney General for the Sovereign Yidinji Government, Gunyara of Yalmabara, and Yalmabara being from the Tablelands, and he's travelled all the way down, and he does so every time we do the show. So thank you very much, Gunyara, for doing that, and for doing us the honour of joining the show, because it's been going on for a little while now, and I think there's some exciting things. We love to talk about sovereignty and what that means for the different tribes on this continent and elsewhere around the world, because many people view sovereignty as different things and have different concepts of sovereignty. And here we talk about how the Yidinji Nation is asserting its sovereignty, maintaining it, but also promoting it for the good and of the world, and that's peace, order and good governance. And I think some exciting times ahead.
Oh, sure is, yeah. Look, and I like coming down here to this part of the world as well. It's literally paradise on earth here. And as you said, it's been going on for some time. It's a decade now, roughly, or a tenth of a century, whichever way you want to look at it. This show has been going for a while. It's a good show to be on and be part of and to try and give advice, because what we do, believe it or not, has impact around the world. It has impact globally.
It certainly does. And, you know, I just got back recently from Machank or Kukutayor territory, which I guess Australians would describe as the Western Cape, York, or Edward River, Pomperow, and did some fishing up there, and that was good, and caught up some familiar faces who are always interested in sovereignty, and especially in what the Yidinji Nation is doing. And I think the elders there have been watching it over the years, and like many other places, you know, people have their own versions of sovereignty. The nation there has started the basic steps, I think, a year and a half, 2 years ago now, and they're still, you know, learning a lot about it. It's something that you're going to have to look at quite regularly, but it's always there, and people not only live it and breathe it, but it's just about how you assert it and the capacity on you know, what's the difference between an Indigenous Australian and Yidinji, for example. Just simple things like that, and I think that's an exciting time that we have we're trying to explain to the rest of the world.
Yeah, look, to understand that we're just humans, we're all humans together, all of us, you know, men, women and children, we're all humans, we're born, we live, we die. And that's the way it is. But about sovereignty, it's about man-made law. It's the ability to be able to have some authority to where you can make law that regulates someone else. Yet, yet another law will grant certain rights to the same people. So, it's a big thing as to sovereignty, because they do have acknowledged coexisting sovereignty on this continent.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the interesting turn of events was the appointment of the Governor-General of the Commonwealth of Australia recently by Prime Minister Albanese. And the new Governor-General is Sam Mostyn. And here there is an article in the Australian Financial Review, and she says something very, very important. I'll read a little bit of it, but I think there might be something there to discuss further. It's basically saying that she's got a strong empathy or strong sense of public service, though all three have been praised through corporate and political circles this week. So she's got a bit of a following, let's say. This is what she has said, this is what has been said about her. In an era when established democracies faces challenges, she will want to build an Australia for all people. After the bruising defeat of The Voice in October put a referendum on becoming a republic firmly on the back burner, and as political and public life grows increasingly polarised, it's a change that can't come fast enough for many Australians. The office is well past the point of needing modernisation. The Governor-General in the role sits uneasily with conceptions of what it means to be a modern democracy. New South Wales University scientia, professor and constitutional law expert George Williams says. Moyston is an innovative and different appointment, he says, after the Prime Minister rewarded a more modern form of public service. So here he is acknowledging the appointment. It's got a lot of people interested from the corporate sector. She's empathetic, let's say, and maybe you could describe her as left-leaning. So she has the matter of the failed referendum at heart, let's say. I think if she's going to make an Australia for everyone, where does it leave Yidinji, for example?
It leaves Yidinji doing what Yidinji's doing. No ifs and no buts about it. But what she has to do, and look, I think she's a little bit more left than centre left of the world. If you look at some of the other channels for media, such as, you know, Sky or whatever, Sky News, they got her really as a radical left, you know, far, far left. But I don't think she's that far. But she's also got a role to fill for the monarchy when the king's not out here now. You know, so she's got to do her part as the Governor General. So she's going to be pretty neutral in general respect of everything. But she does have an understanding about the failed voice and what that means for us.
Yes, I think it's really important that we investigate that. If she's doing the king's bidding, then in his absence, for example, then she may have to receive notice and information and conveyance from people like the Yidinji Nation. Mm-hmm. For example, or other Indigenous nations that have set up in their true and correct capacity their legal entities or their representative bodies that's not Australian, let's say.
Yep, absolutely, because we aren't Australian. You know, she's the Governor-General of the Commonwealth of Australia. We were never Australian. We weren't allowed to be part of Australia. We were excluded 100%. So she's got to build, she's got to build the necessary infrastructure to allow the two worlds to coexist and to get along together. I'm just trying to find a better way of putting it, because Yidinji, believe it or not, is building the bridge from the other side, from our bridgehead. We're actually building a track to the Commonwealth of Australia through, it'll be through the Governor-General and her position, you know, the new Governor-General, to her position in the world and for the Australians, to make a unified Australia. Because if you go back to, I think it was Tony Abbott's House speech, I think it was, back in 2012, he said Australia is not one. It's not a unified world. It's still divided. And she will. This is where this new Governor-General will have a big role to play as the King's representative to bring the bridgehead from their side towards us. So there will be a lot of correspondence going on. There will be a lot of negotiation and talk. But she has a big job ahead of her, considering the earlier Governor-Generals and Attorney-Generals were sort of the white Australia ilk. You know, they were too busy being the colonial manifestation.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Only time will tell, really. And I think there is, among the Commonwealth of Nations at least, this movement to, like, Barbados and a few other Caribbean nations have actually removed the head of state as Charles. They're actually now moving away from that type of model. but with still maintaining the Commonwealth link and unity with the Commonwealth. So it'll be interesting to see how Australia does go down that track of a republic or whatever form it is, but it still will be a manifestation of British colonialism if there's no true settlement with Yidinji, for example.
Yep, yep. And look, a good example for the world to check out, and everyone should, you know, be Governor-General Mostyn, and she'll have a big job ahead of her. But one thing I really recommend she look at is the Haida settlement over in BC, British Columbia. I think that's on the west coast. They are on those group of islands there. That come out recently that they are the true owners, that it always has been Haida country, that it always has been Haida law there. And how the Canadian government, which has, by the way, the same bloke is filling the role as the King of Canada now, which is, you know, Charles. Charles is the King of Australia. He also holds a position over there, King of Canada. But the Haida Nation have come back to life and have started to incorporate their perception of the world into the Canadian life, you know, where the King is, you know, the Commonwealth country, you know, where he's there representing Canada, Haida represent himself. So the same's going to have to happen here.
Yeah, I can see that as clear as crystal. We always have seen that. I guess the job now is to, for both sides, let's say, to sensitively go along this walking together, this journey, without too much friction. And by that I mean not that I think it would receive friction from us, but other actors and could throw a spanner in the works or try to, mix it up a bit.
You know, the biggest problem I see is the lack of education. Simple as that. How can you tell people in the backwaters of like our country, for example, where the highest no vote was recorded, by the way, which really shows the difference compared to down in Canberra, where the highest yes vote was. You know, they up here, they just don't understand the issue, or they don't want to. They still want to maintain their links to the colonial past. And fair enough, and rightly so, because they haven't been told the truth. Everyone deserves the truth in this. And there's been a lot of propaganda put out about, you know, how the sovereignty of the Indigenous nations has gone. It hasn't been, you know, doesn't exist. The court cases are saying so. There's even a Yidinji. There's a case that mentions Yidinji going back a few years, about 10 years ago, 2013, so it's 11 years, where the District Court or the Supreme Court of Queensland said, yeah, the Yidinji nation doesn't have sovereignty in Queensland. And we never said we did have sovereignty inside Queensland, because we're outside of Queensland. We are external. We're foreign. You see a lot of misinformation, especially online, social media, you know, that the Yidinji are just leeches on the social security system, and it's far from the truth.
Well, I was very disappointed with the Cairns Post really painting a picture that was true in parts, but not necessarily the whole truth. I mean, it would have been nice for the particular journalist who was there for the whole day to mention that the magistrate at that time did say that this was not a sovereign citizen movement. He considered it to be not a sovereign citizen movement, and that Matthew, you know, was of good character. He wasn't. There was no case of split personality, things like that. Now, that's really important to convey to the rest of the community, but unfortunately, those particular points were left out, and it sort of left a. And as a former journalist, I think it was a bit wrong to paint that picture like that.
They're basically telling falsehoods by not having the whole truth, which is very important. And that was a case just recently, just only, a couple of months ago, where the Chief Minister, Chief Superintendent of Police, of the Yidinji Police, that is, was picked up last year by Queensland Police. And so there was that interaction between them.
Absolutely. And look at the body cam footage, which was shown in the court at the time. Clear as crystal, Matthew Bilborough was identified, and then someone maybe assumed his personality or his person at the time, which, you know, could be a mistake at law, and it raises so many different questions when we're talking about coexisting sovereignties and things like that. And I think that to his credit, the magistrate at the time dealt with it pretty well, and even the DPP, we shook hands, and I think it's very important. That's the type of intelligent disagreement, whatever you want to call it. That's what's needed to move this whole thing forward, where people win on both sides. It's very, very easy to talk about like that.
Well, I had a bit of a yarn to a very senior academic in the world of Indigenous law and sovereignty and all that sort of stuff. They're a very well-known Australian. And the conversation was, look, it was a face-saving exercise for the Commonwealth of Australia, basically, because the magistrate did threaten to slap people in jail and big fines and do all sorts of stuff, yet the truth came out that he got 120 hours community service. Which was, and no record recorded, clean slate, the whole box and dice. And it was a rather bizarre situation because only last week another young fella tried to do something in the sovereign citizen movement. And he got slapped pretty hard. He got a $2,000 fine or $3,000 fine. He got hit pretty hard because he was wrong. We're not a sovereign citizen movement. This is the hard part for people to grasp, because they haven't been told the truth of the matter is that our sovereignty has never been ceded.
And absolutely, it has been here since day dot. It is a pre-1770 foundation. You can't get better than that. First in time is often preferred at law. And, you know, as we say, Gayabara, God created the Yidinji nation, and for whatever reason, he determined that the Yidinji people would be the holders of the law and custodians of the land, whatever it is, for this piece of dirt on the planet. Not anything more, not anything less, and that's what the truth is. Now, Britain or Australian law is not first in time. It doesn't precede Yidinji. And they know that. They've also acknowledged that in various books and documents and even legal cases in the Federal Court of Australia with native title determinations. And I think good on people like Justice Dowsett and the anthropologists that were involved and the men and women that were involved in telling their story. Because it is there for Australians to read, and it should be there to be some sort of inclusiveness, which is what I love about being Yidinji, is there is inclusion. It's not exclusion.
You're right. But the fundamental problem, and I'll tell you right now, the fundamental problem appears to be the lack of connection. They know we're there. The Commonwealth of Australia know we're there. And it was told to us last year down in Canberra at the Australian National University. You're right. Yidinji is right in what it is doing. It is correct. No ifs, no buts about it. It's not for us to prove our case. You know, the Yidinji don't have to prove their case. It's the Commonwealth of Australia that must prove theirs, which is why I sort of feel that case recently with Matthew Bilbrey, our Chief Superintendent of Police, was make the problem go away. Whatever you do, don't let it escalate to where we can call in all the constitutional experts. Those who were appointed by the Prime Minister, for example, to give advice to the government about the referendum. How would it be if they were all called in to give evidence under oath as to what the matter of sovereignty is all about?
And one of the most important messages to attach to that, Ganyari, is that the Yidinji Nation is doing this for not one Australian dollar. We have made representations to the Prime Minister and Cabinet back in 2017 with, the roadmap to a treaty, for example. And in that document, which was, together with just under 100 pages, there is not one mention of one Australian dollar or taxpayer dollar in exchange for the treaty. And that's really important because I know, and we've talked about it before, you look at when you talk to cab drivers and others on the streets, people are really doing it tough. You see the homeless situation in Ghimoy, Cairns, and people are doing it tough. They can't afford stuff. So why would we want to have a quarter of flesh and a pound of flesh, rather, and a pint of blood to go with it as an added bonus? It doesn't work like that.
Well, quite the contrary. In Mabo 2 decision back in 92, they said the Aboriginals underwrote Australia, basically, or the nation, the Commonwealth of Australia, was built on the backs of the Aboriginal people. They underwrote Australia. Okay? Let's continue the underwriting. How about that for an example? Instead of Australia giving us money, we'll give it some of our value, some of our net worth, because if we own this place, which is what Justice Dowsett said in these native title determinations for up our way, you own this place pursuant to your law, not Australian law. You don't own nothing under Australian law. It's just a way that you can prove ownership. That's all native title does. So if we own it, why don't we continue the underwriting of Australia based on our value of our land and all our resources?
Exactly, and that's what I said to the the exercise at the College of Law there, to the one of the people who are acting like a magistrate or, you know, moot court judge and whatever. What would I know? Ask the federal court judge what it means by that you didn't own the land pursuant to their law. Do I own it under Australian law? Absolutely not. No one does. And but the Yidinji Nation is here to provide the connection to country at an official point, the paper point. The elders and everyone, all the families know who in the zoo from this part of the world, right? You just know people doing welcome to countries here and there. They know who's who. They know who's Giyamwayburra. They know who's Mullumburra and, you know, Yalmaburra and Wajumburra, all that kind of stuff. That's not the issue with us. The issue is, on paper, now the Yidinji Nation can create the piece of paper for Australia to connect its paper to.
Yep.
It's that simple.
It's the off-ramp that we're building for the Commonwealth of Australia. The off-ramp from the colonial manifestation. So we're building our end of that off-ramp. The final part that has to be done will be the Governor-General and the Federal Attorney-General. So we'll have to get Governor-General Mostyn to build the connection from our off-ramp to their main road, to their Commonwealth of Australia. So this is how they can get off their colonial manifestation without having it examined in the international courts, to where we all agree for not $1, and they can save face so they can look as though they have done the job.
Yeah, I mean, I want our police to work with Queensland Police and the Australian Federal Police, for example. Thank you for your service. That's what I said to some of those officers or men that held office providing their contribution to the court at that time. And just while we're at it, I mean, it's the 30th anniversary of the genocide that took place in Rwanda. I wanted to thank John Frewen and the many others that have sacrificed their life to provide security and safety for people around the planet. And good on them for doing that, because genocide is a wicked thing. And there are a number of Australian men and women that were posted over there, and 100,000 or people got murdered and butchered with machetes and things like that. Maybe some people are too young to know about that, but this is what we can do here, is to make sure that those types of things never happen in our lifetime, or in this part of the world at least.
Well, not only the crime of genocide, which is a crime against humanity, there's also quite a number of others, you know, persecution, for example, where one group are out harming and injuring another group like us, you know, so, or oppressing another group, which is a crime against humanity as well. So there's many different forms of crimes against humanity. Apartheid is one, where one group, based on race, suppress or oppress another group for the betterment or for the regime, the existing regime's existence, you know. And look, it is verging very close in Australia to being apartheid.
Yeah, and I think, we're here to make sure that doesn't keep going. But you're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition right across the planet today. Thank you to the Yidinji Broadcast Service and our friends at Bummer Bipra Media, 98.7 FM, to Jackie, Matthew, Trevor, Bumi, and everyone else that goes to that building as well. Thank you for your service, and we'll be back after the break.
Mela, where you from? I'm from the land down under. Level up, let me smoking on ganja. Light up the way and we sound like thunder. No Stevie, but I really wonder. How she move her back like a car, no bumper. I bring heat like a stay in a jumper. 0-1-2-D-10, that's the number. We like the way, came with the crew, familiar faces. Stay straight like I got some braces. Yeah, I slipped up, but I still beat cases. I ain't scared for the time, I'm scared that I can't do shows in different places. Down low, but I up my stages. Feel like 2 Pac, cause I'm going through changes. It's too late, top G like Andrew, yes. I got shows, can't go with no dates. I'm repping my city, the king of my state. Land down under, got me yelling, yeah, mate. I tell the fan that we gon' be safe. Aussie on the map, I'll be repping my game. Lilla, where you from? I'm from the land down under. Level up, let me smoking on ganja. Light up the way and we sound like thunder. No Stevie, but I really wonder. How she move her back like a car, no bumper. I bring heat like a stay in a jumper.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. Gunyara, we were talking about genocide and not wanting that to continue here or any hint of it, really. And this is where I think it's important to let people know that it's, you know, for the police officers, for example, and the magistrates, this is not aimed at you or out of spite or anything like that, but it really needs to be something that the Governor-General or Albanese, the Prime Minister of Australia, needs to tackle head on, because at the end of the day, the buck stops with them. They are the representative, they are the chief, maybe the administrator of the Commonwealth, let's say, and they need to take that information back to the King of Australia, which is Charles, for him to make decisions on, because ultimately he will be responsible for it. And I'm sure that he does not want to stand in iniquity, let's say, when it comes to matters of this particular nature.
Oh, look, very much so. And just for the local, you know, police and magistrates and that, do remember the Rome Statute. The Rome Statute is a very, I suppose, detailed document as to who could be liable for these issues. Now, out of ignorance or uneducation, I'll use our uneducation. They are uneducated people. The magistrate has not been told the truth from the higher up. The police have not been told the truth. The average Australian has been told the truth about what the truth status is on the ground, where these coexisting sovereignties work and live together. So they may be inadvertently, through being uneducated, not told that they may be exceeding the authority of the Australian Constitution, which then brings about the Rome Statute, because, you know, the Rome Statute said no matter who you are, black, white, brindle, no matter what office you hold, be it the Governor-General, be it the Attorney-General, be it the Prime Minister, be it the lowly magistrate, or be it even lower as to a mister, you will be held liable for any action which is a crime against humanity.
Yeah, and it says that very, very clearly in the Genocide Convention Act 1949.
Yep.
As well, so it doesn't matter if you're a public official or a head of state, these things can be brought forward and you will be held accountable. And we don't wish that upon any man or woman, actually, to be fair. I don't want to press claim against any QPS or the magistrate or the Prime Minister even. I think this is something that the minds of men can really, really sort out very, very easily.
And this is the very reason why the Yidinji Nation is building the off-ramp, to give them an off-ramp so they don't go and harm themselves any further. Look, there's got to be a lot of face-saving exercise going on inside Australia, so we need to have them, because they were so wrong, what they're doing, we need to give them some way of saving their face officially. So, look, we understand what's going down, but once you now know, you really can't keep going any further, because if you know the truth, you should stop doing what you're doing and come our way and talk to us. And look, negotiate a system where you can hold your office and do whatever you're going to do, and let us coexist and do what we got to do, and we'll work together for not $1. Actually, there is for money, but the money's flowing from us to them. We'll continue the underwriting, so you are going to get money to do the right thing.
It sounds good to me in terms of, you know, if we can outsource certain things that the Yidinji Nation may not be able to certainly have the capacity to do right now, like a defence force or anything at the international end, you know what I mean?
You mean UNDRIP, UNDRIP, the United Nations Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People. We look after our internal affairs, our domestic affairs, while the Commonwealth of Australia go out and defend the border, for example, whoever we do a treaty with, or whoever we negotiate a settlement with. That's very important, because Australia is not the chosen one yet. We're offering it to Australia, but there's no compulsion for us to offer any formal agreement to Australia.
You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition. Earlier this year, I spoke with Kirill Argyle, who is the president of the Yidinji Tribunal, the court, and about developing, which is coming under your, actually, portfolio, Ganyara. So I spoke to him about setting up a number of things. One is appointing judges and magistrates and how we could actually use that to the effect in a new digital jurisdiction. Gurul, thanks for joining us. I'm just wondering now that the Yidinji Nation moving forward has a number of institutions in place, and through some of the excellent development programs that you've overseen, the Yidinji Nation can now source mediators. But that needs to obviously be increased in time. What other exciting developments can you see and opportunities for the Yidinji Nation to provide its citizens that space for remedy and other things that come to mind?
I think, first of all, just acknowledging the local elders. I want to say that part of my work has involved assisting the state of PNG to develop its mediation service under the National and Supreme Courts there. So working with a judge in PNG who was particularly interested in ADR, he and I went to the Solomon Islands High Court to help train them in mediation, and then we worked together in PNG to bring forward that mediation system by training magistrates and judges initially, and the court and the parliament making laws and regulations in relation to mediation. To me, that kind of process could be reproduced in the Yidinji realm, and we've already kicked off in the practical sense. That is, we've conducted a number of mediation training sessions. And probably the important observation about that, even though the qualification was designed in the Australian realm, it's recognised in the Yidinji realm, and we're offering accreditation in that space. But I do want to emphasise that people who have graduated from that realm, Indigenous folk, have been able to contribute enormous value to mediating matters outside of the Yidinji territory. So the system has shown to work in PNG, it works in Australia, and it will work in the Yidinji territory. So that's one component.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Obviously, that two-way learning that Dr. Yunupingu coined that phrase many years ago is the practical approach that the Yidinji Nation is taking, and it's wonderful to have someone of your expertise and knowledge and wisdom, in fact, that is obviously appreciated by elders here to move forward in this space, because the terms of the Western system, if we can call it that, there are practical benefits, and there is some sort of international standard. Now, having Yidinji producing its own version of that is not only a challenge, but it's an exciting prospect, because we can really focus on what's working out there and have some sort of cultural application and sphere put into that model locally.
I think it's important that what we're doing is we're creating a standard here in the Yidinji Nation. So that's one point. The second point is that yes, it does reflect international standards, and yes, and as does the Australian accreditation system. And so I don't think you can throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think you need to take some of the elements of the mainstream standard, the global standard, and bring that within the Yidinji system and use Yidinji meanings and influences to modify that stance so it's actually useful on the ground here. You can imagine that even the cultural differences between, say, France and the United States or Russia, you would have to take a different mediation approach. It's common in the mediation world to talk about the particular circumstance of Asia and how you might modify your mediation stance. So it's not a great leap. I don't think. It's fairly straightforward.
And I think we're in a good position with the leadership of the elders, because I would say there'd be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my guess would be that there would be a space for the administration or the contract law aspect of it, or citizens may want to opt in into a, let's say, what maybe people describe as an LORE type of environment, where there's a group of peers or elders in there to assist bring that potential conflict or dispute to a halt.
Yes. I guess there's, for me, there's several elements. One is LORE. Then there's a practical day-to-day space whereby people are in conflict and they need mediators, and that might involve people of different cultural backgrounds. So, for instance, in Gimoi, there is a large Papua New Guinean population, and it would seem to me to be appropriate to conduct mediation in Pidgin for that group. Similarly, in matters involving local Indigenous folk, you would need to take into consideration the meanings and kinship relations within that group. You can, so that's one aspect of how the mediation system here is being designed. We've gone with the practical first, train up some people, get some runs on the ground. The next part of the tribunal's evolution, I guess, is to formalise that space and decide which venue, for instance, a particular conflict might be best dealt with. So if it's got a very high level of LORE, it might not in fact be suitable for mediation, but need to be referred back to the elders for dealing with in some formal fashion. So a dispute over a burial might be mediation, or it might be law, or it might be some combination.
One of the things that I think would be very, very practical, you've mentioned that already, is that, yes, Yidinji have accredited mediators have helped outside in the other realm, but to use a baseball phrase, a pinch hitter, if there is let's say, a criminal matter that needs to be heard, not that we would want that at the moment, but we have to be prepared for those things, that's possibly where someone who has experience in criminal codes could interpret the Yidinji law to determine an outcome in a potential case that would be of a criminal nature.
Our recent discussions between yourself and the Attorney General, for instance, have involved the idea of, or at least canvassed my idea around bringing a magistrate from the Australian system to participate in the Yidinji system. Importantly, to bring some rigour to the process, but also to bring some credibility. So that experience, even though it's in a different realm, is important. And in that discussion, I gave the example of in the 70s, after 1975 and Papua New Guinean independence, Australia provided magistrates who were appointed by the PNG system, but were able to immediately get runs on the board to make the system functional. And in my head, there's a similar kind of idea here. We might need to, you know, hold a first step, which might be a gathering of people who have something to say, who've got some runs on the board in the space, who perhaps are academics and might be able to give us some higher-level thought about how to set up the system. And then a next stage would be to enact a system, and that's where I see these experienced people dropping in. And then ultimately we would create our own system with its own regulations and laws and be able to develop that. I still think, and perhaps controversially, that some elements of LAW should perhaps be shared with the Australian state rather than Yidinji trying to reinvent that wheel.
Well, I think that we're talking about practical things. And while it might be the intention of a Yidinji citizen to become a magistrate, we're not there yet. So to like I said, to use that existing resource out there is important. Now, one of the ideas that we have in terms of the private international law space, which is what Yidinji is, and that extraterritorial sovereignty, the Yidinji space could also act as an international peace court to maybe provide a space, a neutral space, for any potential conflict of law between UN member states, for example, or dispute resolution regarding international companies that really want to look at and support something that's a lot more, let's say, neutral, because obviously UN member states all are connected. And that may be an option in the future for tribes that do come back with their legal entities, their governments, for example, that want to not hear their own matter, for example.
I think at the moment I'm more in the camp of trying to get towards that space of there being a Yidinji International Court. Before then, I think it's achievable that we could create an international dispute resolution space. So in the same way that countries are signing up to the Singapore Convention around arbitration mediation, it might be that there's a Yidinji Convention on mediation, which invites not only countries in dispute, but indigenous communities who might be in dispute with their country, in the sense of, not in a Yidinji sense, but in the sense of, say, another Australian indigenous group who haven't asserted sovereignty but have a dispute with the state. One of the things around the Pacific at the moment is climate change adds to conflict. Indigenous communities are intimately connected to resources and country, and climate change is creating issues for them. And those conflicts can be potentially mediated on neutral ground here in Gimoi under the auspices of an international mediation system and a Yidinji international mediation forum court.
Absolutely, and then these are aspirations. Obviously, we don't want to build it tomorrow, but we'd love that if it happened. But obviously, there is a very important process.
I want to interrupt. I think what's important is that these institutions exist already. We're not inventing a new thing. The Singapore Convention exists. At the beginning of that, the comments were, it'll never work. I think the fact that these things already exist, so there's a thing we can model ourselves on, that we have witnessed the development of PNG, I think that's a very good example, because it seems analogous to me between Yidinji Nation and PNG Nation and its development pathway. So while they're aspirations, they have a realistic element to them.
Yeah, and this is what I think where Yidinji is leading that way, because it is about security of personality, security of tenure. I think, in my view, at least, and of the nation, that this is a frictionless cross-border space where peace, order, and good government is the philosophy that's expressed most sincerely here. And I wanted to take you on a little journey down the track into the future, because and these are hypothetical things, but how do you see in the future, let's say the Yidinji was to create a digital space to have some sort of, what we're talking about now, some sort of digital space to hear matters where, crypto laws and things of that nature can be very difficult, because there might be a conflict of law where Party A might say, well, it was the citizen that you initiated by using our money. The citizen might say, well, that digital asset is on a server on a third party or another nation. So it can become a bit confusing there. How do you see that Yidinji making efforts to go down that space, and how, using your future outlook, how could we come up with something that would maybe remedy that situation?
Well, again, it's practical. Yidinji didn't invent digital currencies. They didn't invent, you know, other people have done it. Other countries have done it. It already exists. So the problem pre-exists the Yidinji version of it. And I think clearly there are going to be answers that other people have tried and failed, or tried and succeeded sort of, or tried and succeeded very well. And so my suggestion would be Yidinji shops around and gets the best possible model to enable it. In the digital space, going back to the previous issue, digital platforms can be very helpful in a practical sense. So if you've got a low-key legal matter, criminal matter under a certain value, perhaps AI in a digital space could enable a quick and efficient resolution that delivers justice. There's a saying among lawyers that justice delayed is justice denied, and one of the common problems across the planet is the timing, is the lack of immediacy around justice. Similarly, a mediation platform that dealt with potentially less complex matters could be important in speeding things up. These things would obviously throw out into the human space matters that came into particular conflicts. You could design it so that it did that.
And this is the challenge, obviously, that we do have, because even now, I know that the Commonwealth Secretariat is looking at these types of issues, for example. Mm. But, you know, what would that space look like? Is it Yidinji common law? Is it Rome 1, Rome 2? Is it international convention? Or is it some sort of other law that would regulate that jurisdiction, or that parties would agree to enter into that space, for example? I mean, this is a... I'm putting you on the spot here. I do apologise.
I think the method that I've seen elsewhere is there's an international convention that sets a standard, right? Through pain and suffering, the planet has come up with rules that it says are really, really important fundamentally. So the Dresden firestorm in World War II meant that the UN convention says you can't use weapons of mass destruction. And in particular, you can't design a war system that creates a city-wide inferno. It's completely illegal. So if you have a system with that in place, then your local laws can reflect those standards, keeping in mind that the standards shift. So they're gonna change. I imagine the Palestine-Israel conflict, the Ukraine-Russia conflict will lead to another series of innovation in our international laws. And in my view, I think the Yidinji nation and its legal development should reflect the best of those conversations and changes. There is an enormous problem in Australia around the high percentage of Indigenous people in the justice system. It seems completely inappropriate. There is no practical reason for that to occur. It costs money, it takes time, it occupies the police force, it occupies the judicial system. They're all practical reasons. In more human terms, it creates pain in families and in individuals that is completely unnecessary. I think that what we need to be careful about is how we design a system so that we don't have unintentional consequences. So the application of law inappropriately to a particular group results in awful consequences. People have argued that it is intentional. I don't think we need to go there. I think we just need to look at the fact and say, well, we don't want that. Let's have something else. How would we get to something else?
And this is why we spoke earlier about, is it an LORE to opt into that space, or is it through contract law? Through the citizenship, for example, or the written law and the laws that citizens should uphold. You brought up a very, very good point there, and I wanted to sort of just quickly elaborate on that about unintended consequences. In terms of, once again, putting on your future thinking hat, how can we stop AI from being biased, or how does AI reflect cultural values of the Yidinji Nation, for example?
I was... recently involved in a conversation with an Indigenous person about a database that's used to manage mediation. And that very question was raised. How is this database ethical? which seems like all it's doing is recording information and being used in the circumstance. However, good question. It needs to be thought about. I'm not going to go into that conversation here, but basically concepts around permission, around impact. I think you start with design. You seek to achieve a good outcome with design. But in any design process, your aim for good needs to be measured or thought of in terms of consequence. So however ethical your original design is, if it has a significant human consequence, then perhaps you shouldn't do it. So in specifically around AI, what is it we want it to do? And what do we imagine? We must consider the consequences. How will this be applied? What are the rules and circumstances around its application? How do we retrofit or redesign to improve against those consequential harms?
One of the things there is related to that matter is data sharing. Mm. So how that's being used, that data. Coming back to Udingi and providing potential input into the register of the Udingi Nation, for example, how do you see that operating in the future? I mean, we spoke about that earlier briefly with the Attorney General. How does Udingi share its information about its citizens potentially or vehicles and things like that through that data sharing potential agreements, for example?
Data sharing has a particularly important practical application. So should we do it? Yes. Should we be concerned that, we don't want to end up in a situation where the data that we have shared is being used against us? And so, for instance, you might think back to Nazi Germany or current, North Korea or some of the other more less free states using data against its citizens. So the ethical stance for me would be, how do you design against future potential authoritarian uses in your data sharing regime? Now, right now, I don't have the formula for that. But I believe there are people out there who would have considered this problem deeply, both, and one of the things I often say to people is, listen, somebody back in 1949 already thought this through somewhat, and it's in a book somewhere. And perhaps someone who's got, ready that information kind of on their fingertips can be brought into the process. So the point I'm trying to make there is human experience is broad and deep. Let's use it all.
And that was Gural Argyle there, president of the tribunal, the Udingi Tribunal. And thank you so much for his contribution. Ganyara, some final comments before we go today?
Oh, it's probably a big thing to understand that the current situation has had a couple of years run. It really has. And we're trying to turn around this train that's just full steam ahead. But they're starting to realise now that through the appointment of Governor-General Mostyn, that might be a good turning point. So it is happening, and as with all things, it does take time to slow down and turn around, and it will come about to the stage where they understand the intention of the Udingi Nation and what it's all about. So in saying that, there is a massive education program to go on inside Australia. It will happen, and it'll get there eventually. It's been a good journey the last decade or so, and with this, so it's actually been over a decade, one and a half decades now of the movement. But the as you said about the radio show, it's a decade old, which is roughly 400 shows, which has been around for an hour. It's a lot of time and that we've been pushing at this, and that's why I'm saying it's always a pleasure to come here.
Well, it is a pleasure, and it may not be a pleasure for people to listen to us talk all the time, but that's okay. I hope they're taking the information to empower themselves, their nation, and the Commonwealth of Australia, and the respective states or territories that reside on their territory. Now, Gaibara Galunda, may God's peace be upon you. Wherever you are listening to this program, we really do mean that. And if you want more information about the Yidinji Nation and the government, you can go to www.yidinji.org, and you can find out some more information there. You can become a citizen if you like, if you're living in the territory, and there's a few more things there that can maybe tickle your interest. And we'll catch you next week on your favourite podcast. Garu.